The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Healthy Lifestyle with Lori Ann is brought to you by Northwell Health. Visit them online at northwell.edu. Welcome to Healthy Lifestyle with Lori Ann. I am Lori Ann Castia. Our goal here at Healthy Lifestyle with Lori Ann is to inspire, educate, and empower you to fulfill a healthy, emotional, spiritual, and physical life so you can feel empowered to live the life you have always wanted and dreamed. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I hope you're having a wonderful weekend. And as we had said last show, June is Pay It Forward Month. So we're asking you to reach down and do a little something for someone else. I know we ask this a lot. We want to make it a habit where you go out, maybe get some lottery tickets and put it randomly on cars or give it to someone or hold someone's door or buy their cup of coffee in the morning or maybe their egg sandwich, whichever, whatever makes you feel really good. Maybe you overtip a waitress or waiter that is giving you the best service that you've had in a long time. We just need to accentuate and remember to be kind to one another, and these little random acts of kindness really can change someone's life like you never believe. And maybe it will inspire them to do something wonderful as well. So that's the thought of the day. But I want to bring on, because we have a lot to talk about today, Dr. Matthew Bank. He's the current executive director of the Northwell Trauma Institute, as well as the trauma medical director at North Shore University Hospital. Dr. Bank is a member of the New York Department of Health State Trauma Advisory Committee and the chairman of the State Trauma Advisory Committee Subcommittee on Trauma Center Performance Improvement. In addition, Dr. Bank is currently the chairman of the Greater New York Chapter of the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma. Lastly, Dr. Bank is a member of the U.S. Chapter of Doctors Without Borders. He definitely keeps busy, that's for sure. And Dr. Bank has published numerous articles relating to trauma and critical care. He is the Department of Defense funded investigator, and his current research interests include trauma systems, performance improvement, and the immunological response to spinal cord injuries. Sorry about that. And I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Matthew Bank. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. You make me sound much more impressive than I really am.
Oh my gosh, you are impressive. Stop it. It's amazing what you're doing. So now for the rest of us, tell us what that really all means.
So basically, there are three levels of trauma centers in the United States, levels 1, 2, 3. Level one has the most resources. New York City, being a huge city, has about 24 trauma centers, most of them being level one, throughout the five boroughs, Long Island, and Westchester. I have the privilege of being the trauma medical director at North Shore University Hospital, which is a level one trauma center. And we handle about roughly 2,000 trauma patients a year.
That's a lot of patients. And when you say trauma, what are we talking about? What are the variety of trauma that you, and I know level one, so, you do all different versions, but to help our listeners understand a little bit more.
So basically, trauma is any injury created by force. So the majority of trauma centers in the United States handle what we call blunt trauma. So that's things like car accidents and getting hit by a car, falling downstairs. Literally anything that you could think of. And obviously the vast majority of patients like this who get into car accidents, you know, are really not injured at all. But the more seriously you're injured, the more likely the ambulance is to bring you to a higher level one trauma center. So the vast majority of stuff we do is blunt trauma, which is getting car accidents, getting hit by cars, falling downstairs, something like that. A minority of the stuff, but a growing minority, and especially recently, is what we call penetrating trauma. So that's things like gunshot wounds and stabbing and stuff.
Well, let's talk about that, because just this past Friday, or I guess it's a week ago Friday now, we've had a couple of really intensive issues with gun violence in New York. And does Northwell have an area that takes care of things like that specifically for gun prevention prevention to gun violence?
So Northwell does two things. So number one, we have Northwell has 7 trauma centers throughout the New York area. Mm-hmm. And we obviously handle multiple gunshot wound victims, you know, a year, a month. Also, at the other end, trying to prevent gun violence, because the best way to treat a patient who is shot is just to hopefully get them not to be shot at all.
So, right, yes.
About a year and a half ago, so it's about November, December of 2019, mm-hmm. Mike O'Dowling, who's the CEO of Northwell, mm-hmm. Started the Northwell Center for Gun Violence Prevention. And it kicked off in December of 2019. There was a large forum in New York City that had a lot of trauma surgeons from around the country, as well as other people who are involved in gun violence prevention, and really just opened a discussion of how we can decrease the amount of gun-related deaths in the United States, which is about 40,000 a year. Wow. The United States is one of the highest levels of gun violence deaths in the world. Northwell has dedicated itself to just a discussion of how we could attack this. And the thinking is, instead of politicizing it, and it doesn't really matter who you voted for, what party you're in, or what you believe in, nobody wants a loved one or a friend to be shot.
Of course not.
So really just to think about from a public health perspective. So just as if your doctor, when you went to your doctor, he probably asked you about diet and exercise and whether you're taking your medications the way you should be. They should ask you about guns. Do you have a gun in your house? And if you do, there are some basic common sense things that I think everybody believes in. Making sure that you have trigger locks, making sure you don't store your gun loaded, making sure that no one who's not authorized has access to your gun.
So yeah, well, according to the rules, when you get a gun and you have a license for a gun, and there's the key there, anybody who goes through the actual process, they get a book with all the regulations, and you are required to keep it locked up. You are required to keep the ammunition out of the gun. So those are all things that are processes that are put in place and you have to do if you get a license. In a lot of these cases, do you find that, and I doubt that you really get this side of the information, that's probably our law enforcement side, but do you have any idea if a lot of this gun violence is by guns that have been acquired properly or improperly? Do we know that?
So we don't, as physicians, we don't usually get that. However, I can say that the in the media, you really hear a lot about people getting shot by other people, but more than half of the deaths from firearms in the United States are suicide. And so the majority, again, more than half, probably about 60% of the deaths in the United States are suicide. And that really speaks to having a gun in your home. And as you just said, making sure that it's locked up, making sure that the ammunition is not stored with the gun, making sure you have things like gun safes and trigger locks, and that nobody who's not authorized can get a hold of your gun.
Yeah, and so let's roll this back for a second, because there's an obvious elephant in the room. You know, we've been through a very large challenge over the last 14, 15 months. And in being through that challenge, you know, obviously while we were all shut down, I understand that the numbers decreased significantly in violence across the board, obviously, because nobody was allowed out on the street. So unless it was in the house kind of violence, meaning, family disruptions and things like that. So I saw the numbers when I was looking at them this morning, that they had dropped significantly. However, have you seen an increase since we opened up and started rolling out, at least in the New York City area? Have you seen an increase, or how is this affecting us? Have you noticed in the numbers of trauma patients that you've had?
it's been dramatic. And it's interesting because I'm speaking with my colleagues from all the other hospitals around New York. And what happened was during the really height of the lockdown, so we're talking April, May, June of 2020, the trauma numbers dropped significantly. And that's everything. It was car accidents, people getting hit by cars and gunshot wounds. Everybody was at home and nobody was getting hurt. And then starting in the late summer 2020 up to present, all the numbers have jumped up dramatically. Again, that's everything, car accidents, being hit by cars, but also specifically gunshot wounds have really dramatically increased. And hospitals that used to see gunshot wounds maybe once a month are seeing it once a week, and places that used to see it once a week are seeing it every day. And it's interesting why that happened. The traditional thinking is that gunshot wounds increase when economic conditions get worse. So as people lose their jobs and they're a little more desperate, gunshot wound victims jump up.
So let me
really been dramatic.
Let me that's amazing and but yet not surprising. And it's very sad and it's disheartening that this is what's happening. But so let me ask you a question. So you said it jumped up dramatically year over year, extinguishing and taking out, removing the lockdown section year over year from, let's say, 18 to 19 to 20. Did you see a huge jump or was it about the same when people were allowed to roam the streets?
So to put some numbers around it, it's a little difficult because they're still, really totaling everything up. But right. To put some raw numbers around it, Northwell is a part of an organization called the New York Trauma Collaborative. And New York Trauma Collaborative is about 26 hospitals in the New York area. We all pull our data to just understand different trends in trauma.
Yeah.
So if you look at those 26 hospitals, typically they admit about 3,000, all of them together, admit about 3,000 trauma victims per month. In April and May of 2020, all those hospitals were admitting about 2,000 trauma patients a month. So the trauma volume dropped by about a third.
Yeah.
Starting in September 2020, it started to jump back up. And in the fall, we were admitting about 4,000 trauma patients a month. So it jumped, almost doubled from the time of the lockdown to when things started opening up in the later summer. And it basically continued on that pace right up to now. So, we are at least a third, if not half more. In general, these are all trauma patients, not just gunshot wounds.
Right.
But really dramatically has increased. And we have not seen these numbers in a long time. And another way of putting it, if you look at murder rates in New York City, and a lot of these murders are created by gunshot wounds. But
right.
In general, in 1990, was probably the height, and there's a little over 2,000 murders in New York City in the five boroughs, and that progressively decreased consistently from 1990 all the way up to 2019, where almost every year you were seeing year-over-year drops. And in 2019, they had about 300 murders, so it's about an 85% decrease, which is really, really huge. And this 2021, if we continue on this pace, we're going to be up to maybe 500 or 600, so maybe doubling the lowest level, which was 2019.
Wow.
So, it really dramatically has increased. And a lot of these are gunshot wound victims. And it's difficult to really understand. There's a whole bunch of politicians and everybody who took credit for this drop. And, there are a lot of books written about this, but it is really difficult to understand how New York City went from a fairly violent city in the very early 90s to one of the safest cities in the United States in 2018, 2019, and now it really has reversed.
Right.
Seeing much more violence and much more gunshot victims. And it's interesting because Northwell started the center in 2019, and we obviously could not have predicted that this would jump up like it did, but it's interesting. We started our center and we tried to start this conversation about gun violence and gunshot wound victims just before the upswing started.
That's the new gun violence prevention center that Michael Dowling
right.
had instituted. So
right.
So let me understand this. Northwell is involved with gun violence, and it's through education, correct? I'm trying to understand what Northwell is doing to try to prevent gun violence and how the medical field is going to help prevent gun violence. Obviously, we have an underlying issue that is totally unrelated to trauma. It has to do with emotions. It has to do with psychological things, and an underlying, you know, situation where a lot of people are on a lot of different meds. So do you think any of that contributes to it? And again, back to my original question is, how did Northwell get involved with this?
So Michael Dowling decided that looking at some of the numbers, over 40,000 deaths due to gun violence in the United States, that this was really something that Northwell should get involved with. Northwell is dedicated to the health. And if you look at other diseases, if you had disease that was killing 40,000 people a year, that would be, you know, a major, major disease that we have to tackle. It's more patients that die of gun violence than die of HIV. So I think that was the impetus, just looking at the numbers of people and realizing that Northwell is a healthcare organization that's dedicated to the health of people in the New York area, but also you know, using its influence throughout the country. So that's number one. Number two is the thinking is to treat it as a public health issue and not a political issue. I think when you politicize it, there's a lot of people on every different side of this, and people tend to yell at each other and nothing gets done. But to try to bring people together and try to have some more common sense public health measures to looking at this. One of the things that we're pushing is to have doctors, as we talked about earlier, just have conversations with their patients. Again, they might have a conversation about diet or exercise or taking your blood pressure or your blood sugar at home, but have a conversation about guns. And as you mentioned before, when you get a gun, you know, they're talk about gun safety, but having a physician talk to you, do you have guns in your house? Do you have children in your house? Are your guns secured from the children? Do you have trigger locks? Do you have gun safe? And are your guns secured from anybody in your home who might have a mental health issue?
So that's an interesting question, because in order to get a gun, you can't have anybody in the house with mental health issues, if you're being honest on the application, and believe me, they'll find out. But yeah. I'm trying to wrap my head around how Northwell is, why you would ask those kind of questions, because that would make me very uncomfortable as a patient of someone asking me those questions. I'm not entirely clear where that medical connection comes in. So help me with that, because I really want to understand where that health comes in, other than the obvious, you know, the hurt on the other side.
And it is difficult. I would agree with that. Being a doctor, you know, we originally were not trained for these types of things, but you do have uncomfortable conversations with your doctor, very personal conversations with your doctor about many other subjects. So bringing this into kind of a doctor-patient relationship, where hopefully most people will have a very personal relationship with their doctor and you know, feel more comfortable talking about all the very uncomfortable things that you talk about with your doctor. And just bring this in as one more thing that you talk about. If you have guns, you know, can I help you with gun safety and with a gun course and make sure that you are following all the rules that you said you were going to follow when you first got the gun?
Yeah. And then the other question I have for that is, it seems to me, and again, I'm just making a hypothesis here, it seems to me from your perspective as a doctor, you're looking at the person holistically. So you want to understand every part of their lives. The more you understand about an individual, as I understand it, the better you can treat them. So if you know that there are some issues in the house and you know that there are guns in the house, you need to maybe have that conversation with loved ones, perhaps. I mean, within the HIPAA regulations and things like that. But, you know, you may be able to have a conversation with that patient and talk to them about how they're feeling, why they're feeling, maybe get them help, so that the tragedy that you said was one of the number one reasons why there is gun violence and people coming into your trauma centers is suicide. So that kind of suggests that there are other underlying issues, right? Because you just don't one day wake up and decide decide to do that unless there are other underlying issues, or am I completely off base on this?
No, you're very good. But I 100% agree. To understand everything about your patient, you know, especially in primary care, and to understand that there are guns in the house, and then as your relationship with that patient progresses and you realize that there may be mental health issues in that patient or some of the family, to understand that there are guns in the house already and to start talking about it and having that conversation of making sure that the guns are secured while you're really looking at the patient, you know, holistically is really the goal. And again, trying to take out a lot of the emotions in this and just really talking about it as a public health measure and not, you know, a real political measure. Because a lot of people, I think, when they start getting into the politics of it, they really start shutting down. And
absolutely.
Not what we want.
Absolutely. Hang on for a second. Yeah. You're listening to Healthy Lifestyle with Lorianne. We're going to take a really quick break and then bring Dr. Bank back because this conversation is riveting. Thank you so very much. And hang on there. Come on back. Healthy Lifestyle with Lorianne is brought to you by Northwell Health. Visit them online at northwell.edu. Well, welcome back to Healthy Lifestyle with Lorianne. I am Lorianne. And if you have any questions or comments or ideas, please feel free to email us on at healthylifestylewithla@gmail.com. That's healthylifestylewithla@gmail.com. And also follow us on Healthy Lifestyle with LA. We are on Facebook and we are live. So if you want to jump in, you can always jump in and visit us. In the meantime, we are having a very interesting conversation about trauma and about prevention of gun violence with Dr. Matthew Bank. And I will remind everyone that you are the author of your life, so you get to build the chapters ahead of you. So that's one thing that you want to take into consideration. And doing nice things for other people allows you to write a really good chapter, makes you feel good. Service is why we're here, to have joy, be joyous, and give service to other people. We're supposed to help one another. So I think on this topic, if we're doing that, we don't have time to be hurting each other. So, Doctor, thank you again for joining us. And you know, we left off with why it's important to be getting our healthcare institutions involved with having conversations. There are sometimes difficult conversations, right, with about gun prevention and or gun violence prevention and handling of guns. And if you do have guns, because it is still one of our rights in the Constitution to have arms if that's what you want to do. So having that educated environment, which Northwell is very well known on all topics health related, you really love to educate your patients, right?
Absolutely. And whether you choose to have a gun or not, again, I think having that conversation with your doctor that there are guns in the house, and having a conversation with your doctor so your doctor can talk to things about making sure that they're locked up and making sure that you are the only one that has access to them. And also being able to spot things like problems in your mental health or the health of your loved ones to really have that conversation. And as we just talked about, these are difficult conversations. But many people have very difficult and personal conversations with their doctor. They have hopefully lifelong relationship with their doctor and talking about things about your personal health or very personal, and just adding this one more thing into the conversation about stopping smoking and getting exercise and eating well, making sure that you know, practice gun safety if you choose to have a gun in your house.
Do you have a lot of resistance when you have these conversations, you know, you particularly, but also the other doctors that work with you?
For me personally, it's much easier because I'm usually talking to someone right after they got shot. So they are usually, you know, very open to, at least when they're telling me to my face, I have to say, very open to not getting shot again and talking about it. I think that as a trauma surgeon, unfortunately, I'm always at the kind of end of the gun violence
conversation,
and what we really need to do is get to the beginning are the gun violence issues, so primary care and talking with people. Northwell also was just awarded a $1.4 million grant from the National Institutes of Health to study how to talk to people in the emergency room, because it is a difficult conversation to have, and even harder if you don't already have a relationship with the patient. So if you come to emergency room and there are certain things, if you come to emergency room with a gunshot wound that may not be so serious, or a discussion, somehow you mentioned guns, of how doctors can screen for people who are high risk for gun violence, either suicide or otherwise, and how to start those conversations. It is difficult, and it is difficult to train doctors to have these conversations because many of them, have not been trained to have these conversations, but they treated something like alcohol or just healthy eating habits or healthy exercise habits and healthy gun safety habits, I think is great. And many people listen to the doctors. It's framed in a very non-political, just public health way.
Yeah, this is not a topic. There are so many topics that should not be brought into politics. I don't think that that's something that is necessary. And it's unfortunate that sometimes it gets utilized as a political football. But with that said, I keep hearing things that are really resonating with me. And it seems that it goes back again to us and mental health. It goes back to us and having the right mindset. And if you do or do not know this, Dr. Bank, I am a mindset mentor. And having a positive mindset would really keep you away. It's almost like when my mom and dad used to say, you got to stay busy, you got to stay active, because if you're not, that's when you're going to get into trouble. And I'm wondering if you see the underlying thing as well, is that we really need to look at mental health. Maybe even the reduction of anesthetizing people and giving them tools for every day to be the best them that they can be. What are your thoughts on that?
And absolutely. And I think that is a big part of what the conversation that you should have with your physician, of being the best person you can be. And
yes,
that includes things like diet, exercise, proper mental health. And if you have a gun in your house, of understanding how to have it in your house safely. And who's better to understand that you may be having a problem with your mental health than your primary care doctor that hopefully you have a relationship with for many years.
And
if that doctor realizes you're having a difficulty with mental health, to try to get you to know.
Yeah, no offense. We want to keep them away from you, so that, because if they're going to you, that means they're already hurt, and we want to keep them away from you so that you get a lot more golfing in or whatever your entertainment is, as opposed to, having to deal with these kind of traumatic situations that, in my mind, could have been avoided if we had done something on the front end. It's almost like driving a car every day. If you drive your car every day and don't change the oil, well, yeah, it's going to get rickety. It's going to it's not going to drive as well. It's eventually going to run itself down, and that's when you get crankiness. So even your car stalls out. So that's when maybe we make bad choices and we're not drinking water, we're not eating healthy. We're eating things that are making us even crankier, and that just adds to a mindset that puts us in a position that may have us make bad choices. And, there are a lot of people who, and please don't write me letters, there are a lot of people out there who are gun owners who are very responsible, and I totally respect you, and you do follow the rules. And there are many people out there who don't have guns legally, and those are the ones I think that are making it very difficult, is that there are a lot of illegal guns out there. And I know there are a lot of initiatives to take those guns back and make your job easier. I'm sure you would like to spend some of your time in other areas in your trauma care area to help other people for other trauma situations, right?
I'm always trying to put myself out of business. It's one job where you go out there and try to put yourself out of business.
Yeah.
The analogy to driving a car is very accurate. We could talk about driving a car and putting your seatbelts on, and we're not going to tell you not to drive your car. But if you have children and you go to your pediatrician, he should be asking you whether you have a child seat and whether you are able to, you know, drive your car with that child safely. And it's the same thing with guns. If your pediatrician knows that you have a gun in the house, just make sure that it's, you're handling it safely, you're following all the regulations, and also be monitoring your mental health.
Yeah. And so I just want to shift a little bit and ask you this other question. I had indicated that you are a Department of Defense funded investigator. What does that mean? Sounds really cool.
Yeah,
do you have theme music?
No.
We're going to have to get you some.
but with one of my colleagues, Ona Bloom, who is a PhD researcher at Northwell. Northwell has a research arm called the Feinstein Institute, which has hundreds of PhDs working for it, and then anywhere from epidemiology to some really basic science research. And Ona and I looked at spinal cord injuries, so looking if we could develop a blood test that after spinal cord injury would tell people their prognosis, because after a trauma and you're paralyzed, unfortunately, the question always is this going to be permanent? Am I going to recover? So we're trying to develop a blood test that, you know, just be like a blood test for HIV or any of the other blood tests you have for cancer, that will be able to tell you your chances of recovery from a traumatic spinal cord injury.
That is so fascinating to me that you can actually determine that. It just befuddles me completely that you're able to do that, and I'm just so grateful that people like yourself and all that building full of PhDs, that's what they do. They focus on that. They get the data. They really, you know, these are professionals, scientists that are really you know, shaking that data down so that we could utilize it on a day-to-day basis, and it gets just better and better. So something else that it mentioned with this, as an investigator, you're working with, and I'd love to know more about it. It's interesting. The immunological response to spinal cord injuries. What exactly are you looking at that? I mean, are we talking immunization, you know, immunization or being immunized to it?
No. So what happens after you have a spinal cord injury is that the nerves in your spinal cord degenerate. So, you know, they die. But you have other cells in your body, your skin cells or other cells in your gut that can die, but then they actually, you replace your skin.
Right.
What is it about the...
it's kind of our version of a starfish.
Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So what is it about the spinal cord? How's your immune system interact with your spinal cord, and why does your spinal cord degenerate after a injury like that? And that leads to, again, having a blood test, because once we understand what the mechanisms are, the actual chemicals of what's happening in your spinal cord when you're injured, you could pick up some of those chemicals in your blood. We don't have that yet. I don't want everybody to run out and say, oh, I can just get this blood test. So we were hoping to discover it.
So, right.
So if we do discover it, you can remember the name of Ona Bloom, because she'll be the scientist who discovers it. But if you look at all the chemicals that are surrounding your spinal cord and why the nerves are not able to regenerate, you know, maybe it has to do with your whole immune system and how your immune system is affecting this injury. But once we figure that out, we'll be able to figure out you know, what these chemicals are in your blood, be able to pick that up.
That's ridiculously amazing.
It requires a lot of work. There are some other animals, lampreys, which is a kind of an eel, which, believe it or not, regenerates the spinal cord. So looking at the lampreys and seeing how they regenerate, and that giving us ideas of what could happen in the human.
And maybe how we could do that in because our bodies are amazing. It can combat, it adjusts to environments. It adjusts. If anybody's ever lived in the north and then moved to the south and then going back to the north, they were fine before they left with the cold. But when they go back after their body adjusted to being in a more tropical environment, when you go back to the north, it's even colder. It's amazing. I just love what our bodies can do and how it could heal if we do the right thing, if we give it the energy, if we give it the water. That's why, you know, I will be a huge proponent forever about drink your water, because we're 70% water. And correct me if I'm wrong, Doc, but that's what I'm understanding. And that we need to replenish that and keep that live water coming in and just circulating it out and helping our body replenish, right?
that you drink your water and exercise.
Absolutely. Movement is important, whatever that movement means to you. I mean, just getting out walking, just getting your heartbeat up through walking is good. So whatever that means to you, just do it, right?
Absolutely.
I love it.
Diet and exercise are probably the best things you can do.
Say again?
Diet and exercise are probably the best things you can do.
Yeah, yeah. That's what you do for yourself to make yourself, you know, it goes back to the adage of putting your oxygen mask on first in the plane. They say that because you need to be strong so you can help everybody around. And if you want to serve everybody around you, you need to have your health. And that's the biggest gift of all is our health and loved ones, of course. But I have a question for you. What's your why? Why did you get into this?
That is really interesting. It's funny. I say that, some people say I'm not really a doctor, but I play one on TV.
But do look like an actor on TV, and I'm trying to figure out who.
when I was a kid, I watched these medical shows. It was as simple as that. And the doctors in the emergency room always seemed the coolest doctors on that show.
They are pretty cool.
I always wanted to do that. Unfortunately, we're not quite as good as the doctors on TV or as good looking. But really, that was my inspiration when I was a kid. There was the show MASH.
Sure, yeah.
Really, 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 really. And I loved that. I never missed an episode. They were my heroes. Those guys were my heroes.
You kids, if you don't know what MASH is, if you go to like a Hulu or if you go to TV Land, you'll find what that is. It's a really great show.
Yeah, it was Alan Alda, and I'll be honest, I never missed an episode, so it was really just watching TV and thinking these guys were the coolest people, and I wanted to be like them. Unfortunately, it's not quite as cool as it was on TV, but we're not quite as good looking, and we don't save everybody. We try to save everybody, but we don't end up. But I still find it, even after I graduated medical school in 1995, so that's 26 years. Wow. Making myself feel really old.
We don't do math here.
Yeah. Every day when I go to work, I still think, you know, it's a privilege to be able to go to work and try to help the next person that comes through the door.
Yeah. Is it the excitement of the constant? You don't know what's coming in. It's that change. It's things are just coming at you. That's what in observing emergency rooms and things that you're doing and other doctors are doing. Is it that constant change, that adrenaline rush of coming in and then solving those problems like rapidly? Because in the emergency room and in trauma, you need to really pick up the pace to figure it out, because sometimes you just have windows where it will make a difference between someone having a better result, right?
There's some people that really don't like that type of stress, but you know, for those of us that really thrive on it, I worked last night, and when I show up for work, and you never know what's going to walk through that door, and just handling each thing as it comes, and seeing one patient and solving one problem, and then moving on to the next is exciting. I never know what's going to happen as soon as I show up, and something could happen in the next 5 minutes. That, you know, changes my whole night. So it is very interesting. Again, a lot of people tend not to like that, but if you do like that, then trauma or emergency medicine are great fields to go into.
You sound like somebody who would definitely jump out of a plane or do bungee cord jumping or something like that.
I've seen a couple of people whose parachutes didn't open, so I'm a little scared of jumping out of a plane, but I think it would be thrilling.
Yeah, well, we come from the airport, so this is where the studio is. So that just came to mind, and there's just no way I would jump out of a plane. So no worries, I'm standing on the sideline with you, cheering anybody on who wants to do it. But yeah, that does not incentivize me. But it's so exciting what you do, and it's so wonderful what you do that you chose this as a career, and you're still so passionate after 26 years about what you do. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. You know, best story that you have in one of your cases, without obviously mentioning names, quickly.
And this is just a recent case of a patient who we were talking about gun violence, but who got shot a few years ago, and came in, and my partner and I handled him, and was as close to death as you were possibly ever going to be. Your heart stopped in the operating room. And eventually we got him back, and through months and months, multiple surgeries, eventually left the hospital. And very recently, he came back to my office and was sitting in my office, and I, I went to see him, and in my mind, I'm like, who's this? I've never seen this person before in my life. And then he mentioned his name. I looked at his chart, and I could not believe it was the same person, because the person I remember was, you know, really sick in the ICU and the hospital, and this was a guy who drove himself to my office. I wanted to talk to me and was completely, you know, back to his life, had a family, had a new girlfriend. And it was just really, really just so satisfying to see somebody that was that close to death and now, you know, had completely back to his family and back to his life.
Truly
that,
heroic.
That was just last week, actually, he came to my office.
Wow, that's truly heroic. And, you know, making a difference like that is what we're all here for. And that just must be so amazingly fulfilling. So what a role model you are, Dr. Bank. And thank you so much, really, for being on our show. Last thoughts?
Just, you know, if you have a gun, please, you know, make sure that you have trigger locks. Make sure that you're handling safely. Take a gun safety course. Please, you know, talk to your physician about it.
Beautiful. Thank you again, really, for being on the show. Thank you all for listening today and joining us here on Healthy Lifestyle with Lorianne. My heart is always lifted by sharing this time with you, and I hope you enjoyed our show today and the conversation that we have. I'm looking forward to seeing you all again next week. Same place, same bat channel, if you will. Remember, do a little something for someone else. It doesn't have to be big, but just a little something. It's a really good habit to develop. In the meantime, thank you for joining us on Healthy Lifestyle. I am Lorianne Kasdia. Until next time, play a higher role, serve a higher purpose, show up for you, and show up big.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting, management, or its sponsors.